Welcome to the Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Crystal Starr. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, Colette LaBeouf talks with Stanley Crawford. Crawford, with his wife, Rosemary, own El Bosque Garlic Farm in Dixon, New Mexico. Crawford is the author of 9 novels and 2 memoirs, which include A Garlic Testament, Seasons on a Small Farm in New Mexico, and Mayor Domo, Chronicle of an Acequia in northern New Mexico. A little later, we will hear from Rizal Benali, an emerging independent filmmaker dedicated to creating stories with strong indigenous female protagonists. Here's Colette LaBeouf's conversation with Stanley Crawford. They start off by talking about Crawford's 2019 book, The Garlic Papers, A Small Garlic Farm in the Age of Global Vampires. In the fall of 2014, Crawford questioned U.S. tariff exemptions for the country's largest importer of Chinese garlic. This set off a massive legal battle, pitting his small New Mexico farm against the importer and its international law firms. In the book, Crawford describes his personal and farming life under a cloud of lawsuits and administrative skirmishes. The unusual case was of such interest that it became the subject of a Netflix documentary, Garlic Breath, part of the series Rotten, released in 2018.
So Stanley, thank you for talking to me today about the Garlic Papers, but other things too, is what I'm hoping. I guess I want to start out talking about the book itself, which is pretty new, and asking you about, has there been any update since the book has been published? That is this ongoing?
Well, first of all, great to have you here down at the farm, Colette. And yeah, it's still ongoing. I can't remember whether I got it into the book. I've been dropped from the racketeering suit, as has Ted Hume, my attorney friend in Taos. So that's no longer an issue. As a condition of that, we agreed to be interviewed. I was interviewed for 5 hours in the basement of the Inn of the Anasazi by 2 of Harmony's lawyers. But they apparently didn't get anything out of me that they could have used maybe in China, so they have never interviewed Ted. I don't know how many thousands that exercise cost them, but a lot. We keep losing our appeals with the Department of Commerce and the Court of International Trade, and probably the last of those will be coming up fairly soon. But I'm actually going to reapply, make another request for review in November on my own. In the past, I've had a couple of other farmers, friends, join in the effort, but their paperwork hasn't been really up to snuff for commerce purposes. And mine will be, partly because I've made my employees, my interns employees rather than contract workers this year, and have lots of good paperwork on that. And I'll be digitizing my records and so on and so forth. So I don't think Commerce or Harmony are really going to expect me to apply on my own. Ted will help me with formatting, but he won't be involved either. And he's been something of a lightning rod. So that will be the last act.
But this has been long and ongoing.
We'll be entering our 7th year.
It's amazing. And this just, I mean, this, before this happened, this was not a world that you were even considering being involved in?
Not at all, but that's been the interesting part, is I've got to know the world of import-export, the legal system. I've had 2 trips to China out of this. So it's really expanded my horizon considerably, which has been, well, it's basically what I've covered in the book, but and it hasn't been that stressful. It's been very stressful for Ted as an attorney because his reputation has been under attack, and this is has been his livelihood, this kind of work. So, but for me, it's been more of an adventure, you might say.
Well, I'm just going to, as we talk, read a couple of passages to you, because I feel so, I'm so interested in the fact you talk about this as an adventure, and I think part of that is because you're a writer, this is an interesting intersection as a nonfiction writer and a fiction writer, this sort of combining of this world that gets kind of open to you through the experience. One of the first passages that struck me is on page 23, in an era of increasingly complex forms of internet-enabled dependencies, this is no small thing. A working farm becomes the center of the universe for those who work its land and crops and tools and machinery, a refuge and a sanctuary from the gravitational forces of the 24-hour news cycle and social media, trying to pull you away from a place-centered life, luring you to click your way out into the void. And I love that because it feels like both this book negotiates that, the farm as the center, and also the pull through this experience out into news or the 24-hour cycle you talk about. What's that experience like, sort of being between now the farm and everything else? And I would say not just this case, but...
Sure. Well, I get, you know, the New York Times and all kinds of national publications, but I don't actually read anything until the evening when my day is done.
Okay.
When I also listen to NPR. Mm-hmm. So in the morning when I get the paper out of the mailbox at the end of the drive, I see the headlines and, you know, just put it away. So my day is pretty much centered on the farm and the house and my interns and all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. At nighttime, I, you might say, go out into the world through TV series. As I said earlier, I like to watch TV series because they're only an hour. Mm-hmm. A movie is too long for the mm-hmm. evening. And I watch things after I get tired of reading. So, mm-hmm. and then I resume reading. So, it might, in a sense, when darkness falls, that's when I, you might say, go out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what does the world look like to you from Dixon right now?
It looks pretty bad. Mm-hmm. I don't know where to start, and maybe I won't start, but...
Yeah.
Climate change, politics, the pandemic. I think we're at a confluence of many, many bad things happening at once, and I'm hoping that this confluence will initiate the kinds of change that I think everybody recognizes needs to be done in terms of environment, in terms of politics, and you know, especially in terms of the economy.
So what kind of movies? What kind of TV series?
Oh,
what
gosh.
Are you watching right now?
I just finished the two series, Young Pope and the New Pope, which is very strange, interesting. Mm-hmm. Before that, I watched a 5-season French series called The Bureau, hoping to help my French along. It was very well done. Don't get me started.
The series, they are fun. They are fun. One of the chapters I really liked, just thinking about this book as not just a piece of nonfiction from someone researching, but from a writer who is a fiction writer, also was chapter 9, talking about, you know, walking into a McDonald's. And this difference between fiction and reality. The book seems to really explore fiction and nonfiction from the writing perspective also, and your encounter of both. Is that, as a writer, is that how you approached this book, with that exploration, or how did you approach this project?
The book, I started trying to write a second farm book. The first farm book, of course, is The Garlic Testament, and which I published in, early 90s, anyway.
Okay.
So a lot has changed on the farm since then. Mm-hmm. We've been through a lot of different cycles and changes in practice and so on and so forth. So I thought it was time to update it, but I couldn't find an arc on which to hang it. I didn't want to do seasons on a small farm again. So I've been working on, you know, various chapters, but it wasn't hanging together. And finally, I woke up to the fact, oh, the China thing. That's what I can hang it on. Mm-hmm. And then the challenge there was to make the legal crap readable. So I couldn't really, unload that all at once. I had to sort of meter it out gradually, mm-hmm. so that the reader would stay with me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the process. I mean, I've done columns about the farm for years, if not decades, for various publications. And some of the columns I rewrote, some of the material is new, mm-hmm. For the book. So that's kind of how it all came together.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me thinking about the book, also the way that it feels very concrete and then also like a spy story. So, you know, you're talking about machinery in some passages and then what is happening in China, you know, when you go and trying to figure out everything or your impressions of that trip. You say at some point, a garlic farm is not fictional. And there's that sense as the book goes on about just the constant materiality of this life. And you have this intrusion of paperwork, which feels not apparent. So that was interesting to me. Let's see. There's another place I wanted to look at. See, I go back to my graduate student tricks of writing down passages. Page 80. You're talking about the Santa Fe Farmers Market, which we were talking about a little while ago. But a marketplace is better when it's not just about business. And business is better when it is about more than just business. When it's also about making connections of a philosophical, social, or political nature. And I was wondering if you could talk to me about that, about what the experience of the market is for you, has been, but also is now.
Well, it's different now, of course, but because it's often hard to recognize people you know until they talk to you. And, of course, we're not encouraged to spend a lot of time talking to people closely. So, but there's still, I would say, a pretty high degree of exchange. Mm-hmm. Even with, you might say, the barriers that we all have to maintain, distancing and so forth. But, I became aware of this the first time. I can't remember whether I wrote about it. When I was working as project director to develop the new site, the permanent site in Santa Fe, I traveled around the country to visit other farmers markets. And I was at a farmers market in Seal Beach, where I have cousins, California, and just noticing the produce is absolutely fantastic, and you know, given California. And I asked someone about their garlic, and they didn't really have time to talk to me about it. And then I started listening. What I was hearing was, you know, thank you, that'll be $3.95. Thank you, goodbye, hello, thank you, $3.95, whatever. And I came back to Santa Fe to the market and realized you couldn't walk 10 feet down the market without somebody buttonholing you and wanting to talk about something. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, defined it as a community market as opposed to just a farmer's market.
And do you think that's particular, that's Santa Fe or this New Mexico, or what do you think that is?
It could be New Mexico. It could have to do with the size of the community. Mm-hmm. For example, if you go to the Green Market in New York City, the chances of running into somebody you know is pretty remote because mm-hmm. there's just so many people there, mm-hmm. except the sellers, the farmers and producers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a function of the size of the community, and I think that there is a very strong sense of community in Santa Fe and Taos in particular, mm-hmm. That may be somewhat unique.
That was Colette LaBeouf talking with Stanley Crawford. When we come back, more about Crawford's community, both in Dixon and as a writer. Stay with us. Welcome back to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Crystal. Colette LaBeouf has been talking with Stanley Crawford. He has lived in Dixon, New Mexico since 1969, where he and his wife, Rosemary, built their own adobe house. They have farmed since the early 1970s, specializing in garlic and selling at both Santa Fe and Taos farmers markets. During the growing season, the farm is open to the public from 3 to 5 p.m. for Farm Friday. Crawford currently has 7 novels in print and 3 works of nonfiction about living in northern New Mexico. Here's Colette LaBeouf talking with Stanley Crawford.
Is there a community in Dixon? Is it big enough to feel that there's a community here?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a very strong community. Mm-hmm. We have the wonderful library. It actually received international recognition during the Obama administration. We have a fantastic co-op that's been running for 10 or 15 years now, mm-hmm. and which even the USDA said is unique because it's not a middle-class co-op. Most co-ops tend to be middle-class co-ops, and this is serving the entire community. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. was a decision that was made early on, not to make it a granola co-op, but you know, have stuff that, you know, I suppose cigarettes and junk food, for example. I don't exactly approve of the cigarettes, but at the same time, it brings people in and they'll buy other things. And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. And we have a deli, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. so you can get sandwiches and burritos and, you know, excellent pizza. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So I'm interested in, you mentioned when we talked on the phone that you'd recently finished a novel.
Right.
Can you tell me what the novel's about? Or,
well, it's a peculiar one. I just sent it to Leafstorm, my publishers of the last two, and I haven't heard back yet. But there's two parts, and the first part is set in Lesbos, in the village of Molevos in 1964. It's probably the most autobiographical thing I've ever written. It's when I became a writer, though I wouldn't yet have called myself, but it was when I wrote my first published novel. I was there 6 or 8 months. And then it's when I discovered I had a body. That was an interesting discovery. And it was when I, not exactly perfected my French, but I brought my French to a more colloquial level. I'd gone to school in France at mm-hmm. the Sorbonne, and my best buddy there was a French painter, and he didn't care about English, but he was a great source of, you know, helping me make my French more colloquial. Mm-hmm. So those are three very important things, and it was such a transforming time in my life that I couldn't write about for decades. And
had you tried?
I tried. I'd written about half of the current exercise, and I went back to Lesbos, to Molevos, what, almost 2 years ago now, and that kind of helped me finish mm-hmm. the book. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, the change, because when I was first there, there were two cars in the village, one belonged to the village doctor and the other an English writer, and now there's a car rental agency. But interestingly, the beach, which I went to every day with Francois, has not changed that much. Hasn't been developed, which is wonderful. And the village, you know, it's a historic place, so it hasn't changed, except there are tourist shops everywhere, and there were none when I was there. Mm-hmm. So it was where I met my first writers, among whom William Golding. Mm-hmm. He was there for about a month mm-hmm. with his wife.
Mm-hmm. So formative in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And
so that's part one.
Okay.
Part two is I'm calling them nonfiction essays. They are set here, and they represent what I actually think. They reflect on the novel and the writing of the novel. But they're fictional in the sense that I don't write them where I say I write them, and I don't write them when I say I write them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that makes up part of this project,
yeah,
this book.
It's two parts. Yeah.
So interesting. So formally, chapters in the first section and discrete essays in the second.
Right.
Interesting. And how did you decide on that form? As opposed to just the novel, or, you know, just the prose separate from essays?
Good question. I'm not sure. I think maybe I felt that the novel wasn't, or novella maybe more mm-hmm. properly, wasn't quite enough. Mm-hmm. There were some, well, actually, no, there's a better answer. I lost track of this French friend, Francois, and his sister, Catherine. I was in love with both of them. And so we corresponded when I came back to the States in 68, 69. And then we lost track. And back in the day, you could lose track of people. Mm-hmm. You know, they get married and change addresses mm-hmm. and don't tell you. And so I thought, well, I tried the internet, couldn't find anybody. I'll never see them again. They may not even be alive. Well, I was teaching at Colorado College in January, and at the end of a lecture by a guest lecturer, Levi Romero, actually, mm-hmm. I checked my email, and there was an email from Katrine.
Wow.
After 50 years.
Wow.
So I thought, oh, this story isn't over. Mm-hmm. So that led me to write this part two. I wrote one version, I just threw it out. It was two, it didn't work. And then I rewrote it. And I've always wanted to write or intended to write a piece of an old man sitting by a river. I mean, the metaphor is pretty trite, but and reflecting on his life. That ended up being the first attempt, ended up being The Canyon, the novel I wrote in San Miguel de Allende. It wasn't an old man, it was a 13-year-old spending summers by the river, a river in Colorado. So anyway, this is basically an old man sitting by a river reflecting on his life. but I hope it's but reflecting, you know, on this past experience
yeah.
and the novel and so forth and the writing of it. And it talks a lot about fiction and, you know, mm-hmm. fiction and non.
So that's in the hands of the publisher right now. Are you working on a new project?
Well, I have one for the winter, which I'm not talking about,
okay.
which I think will
okay.
be a lot of fun.
Okay, excellent. I understand that. So I guess related to this, you know, my interest in your writing life, I'm always curious about this for writers. I mean, it's a solitary act. No one can help you do it. and yet we write in conversation with contemporaries or
sure.
predecessors. What's your writing community like for you? Is this solitary? How do you?
Well, I guess I consider my community to be basically three friends. One is a former editor of mine at the Overlook Press, who actually didn't edit anything of mine. He came in at the last minute. And I met him when I went to New York for a reading, and we became friends. And he now teaches Western American literature in Tucson. But he's an excellent editor, excellent critic. I really like his whatever he says is helpful. Another is a former Knopf editor, not mine, who became an architect and helps out in the summer. She lives in Philadelphia, and her husband plays for the opera. Mm-hmm. So they're out here during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very good reader. And then the other is a young he's sort of a counselor at St. John's, but he's also a writer and a publisher. And I mean, he's a Renaissance young man.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to know each other because I didn't know this. He was 18 years old and he bought an option film for the film rights of my third novel.
Which is what? The log
of the SS, okay. the Mrs. Angutin. The best thing I ever wrote. Anyway, we corresponded. I didn't know he was 18 years old. He had been one of the stars of The Secret Life of an American Teenager, a series so bad that he himself had only watched one episode. 5 seasons of this.
Oh, my gosh.
He made a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
We lost contact, reestablished uh-huh. contact. He was on his way to St. John's at 23. And I invited him up to dinner. I didn't know any of this about his life. And his wife had been in Superbad and a lot of police procedurals, but they'd kind of escaped the whole Hollywood scene.
Mm-hmm.
So we started talking about manuscripts and books, and I told him about this manuscript I had withdrawn from trying to publish it for various reasons. And he wanted to see it, and I gave it to him. And he wrote, emailed back, and from Santa Fe, he was now a student, and said, you have to get that out. So I rewrote it or read it to the computer again and published it. So anyway, he's my other reader.
Mm-hmm.
Then it sort of fans out.
Right. So it's that's small.
Those are ones I show stuff before it even goes to a publisher.
Yeah. And you've taught a lot over the years also.
Oh, actually, I didn't. I taught back in the 70s for a while, which I didn't like, and then I went back to it in 2010, I think, UMass, at the same time, Colorado College. So I do Colorado College every other year, roughly.
And what do you teach there?
Southwest Lit.
Okay. Yeah. And do you teach fiction or
both?
Just
fiction
both?
And nonfiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
But not poetry.
Not poetry. I'm not very good in that area.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And Colorado College is Colorado Springs?
Right.
Or okay. Okay. And do you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. It's a writing intensive course. It's a diversity requirement or satisfies a diversity requirement. So I get a lot of students from outside of English. And maybe I'll have one or two English students, English department students, who are not always the best. You know, I'm not a scholar, and where I can help them is with their writing. So I've sort of turned it into a kind of writing workshop.
Love that.
The students, they write two papers a week plus a term paper. So they write maybe eight, or I see them individually eight times. So they bring their papers, they Xerox them in the office or wherever, bring them, read them to the class. The class critiques them. I don't say much. And then I meet with them individually, and then I give my thoughts. So I meet with each student about eight times in the course of 3.5
That's
weeks.
That's great.
That's where I can have some effect.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I really enjoy it. And one of my interns is, I should have had three interns from Colorado College. And I used to be kind of cagey. I'd sort of casually mentioned I also farmed, blah, blah, blah. And this time in January, first thing in the class, I introduce myself and I say, the only reason I'm doing this is I need a farm intern.
Basically, right? I love that.
So right away, I got one.
Before this conversation started being recorded, we were talking about you had been involved with the TAA, also now the TCA. So you've seen the TAA or the TCA be part of Taos. What do you recall about, aside from maybe any board meetings, what do you recall that it was able to contribute to the community in the time you were involved? I'm interested, I guess, because I arrived in Taos in 2018. Mm. So for me, I hear a lot of stories about how it was.
Well, my wife, Rosemary, played in a lot of plays and actually wrote children's plays and had them performed up there. And I've never been a fan of musicals, but I love the community musicals. They were always a riot, and I really looked forward to them. I can still vaguely remember some of the scenes of them. So, you know, I think the theater there, I've seen productions, well, at least two productions in Taos that I thought were among the best I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of things in New York. And I think one of them was, it was actually a backstage production, Harold Pinter's No Man's Land. It was just extraordinary. And then Rosemary was in The Road to Mecca. And I had seen that play in Santa Fe. Rosemary also saw it with a professional actor's friend in Seattle. And when I saw it in Santa Fe, Athol Fugard has a kind of funny way of almost putting you to sleep and then bang, something happens. At the end of The Road to Mecca, the ending was so powerful. I was not in an aisle seat. Had I been in an aisle seat, I would have jumped up and run out of the theater. Rosemary, I don't know how many performances they had, three or four, and I saw them all. And every time I was surprised by a turn in the plot. It was not, you weren't looking forward. You were so engaged that you forgot how this is going to turn. I was part of the film committee at that point, and we struggled to find films that would attract a crowd that would pay for the film. And so us film nuts were, well, we got to show these Eastern European, you know, Czech and Polish, and, you know, we get a small turnout. So finally we did, I don't know whether it's Siddhartha or something, you know, that had a kind of mystical tinge. We had people lining around the building to get in.
Right.
Oh, that's the formula.
Right.
So we would do, you know, that kind of thing, uh-huh. which we weren't that interested in, but we knew it would uh-huh. get a crowd. And then we'd get the things we wanted.
Uh-huh.
And then we filled the house with Paris, Texas.
Oh, wow.
The fantastic film. We Love filled the house with the James Joyce film, The Dead.
The Dead.
So it was interesting kind of figuring out how to balance our taste with the needs of the community.
Stanley, this has just been wonderful to visit with you.
Oh, same here.
Thank you. And I recently talked to someone who is a huge fan of yours. I interviewed a woman living in New York, and I told her we were talking about the radio show, and I said I was coming to visit with you, and she said, you were one of her favorite writers. She had not read the Garlic Papers or the Garlic Testament, but your novels she had read. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Colette.
That was Colette LaBeouf talking with Stanley Crawford. Let's take a break. And when we come back, Chelsea Reedy discusses filmmaking with Rizal Benali, currently pursuing her MFA in film production, focusing on directing at Tisch School of the Arts at New York University. Here's more music from Sam Prekop's album, Comma. Comma is Prekop's modern, minimal pop album that taps into the experimental heritage of the synthesizer. The album places Sam Prekop's work squarely in the tradition of electronic music pioneers like Brian Eno and Yellow Magic Orchestra, who brought together the unrestrained ambition of the avant-garde with the immediacy and accessibility of pop music. Welcome back to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. Film director and writer Rizal Benali is currently attending Tisch School of the Arts at New York University as a second-year MFA candidate in film production focusing on directing. She was a 2015 Sundance Institute Native Lab Short Film Production Fellow with her first narrative, I Am Thy Weapon. Raven, her BFA thesis film, which she completed at Institute of American Indian Arts, garnered considerable attention on the festival circuit. She is currently in development of her first feature narrative film titled Winter in Black Mesa. Chelsea Reedy talked with Rizal this summer.
So I'm in the graduate film program at New York University at Tisch School of the Arts, and I'm studying directing screenwriting. And it was my second year last year, or this past year, and I was in spring. And we did go home. A lot of us went home to our communities or back to be with their family, you know, where we all live and come from. Actually, I have a funny story. I was at the airport. I was at my gate waiting to board, and the email came through, and it, like, national news broke and saying that we're not going to be in school starting that, like, Thursday or Friday. And so I just didn't get on the plane. I just walked off.
So what's it been like during this last, 3 or 4 months, continuing your, you know, your study and your growth and doing that without being around other people, like you mentioned earlier, how that's such a neat part, these labs and stuff, the gathering of people and the conversations that can happen. Are there plus sides to this type of remote work or no?
Yes. And I'll start off with a no. It was extremely hard for me to adapt to this. I am a very much a people person. I like to surround myself with, you know, other human beings, and we talk and we laugh and we connect. And that's what I miss most, is that being around people and just either working or existing and like not having to like force conversation. I'm here with my family and everything. And it's been great. Oh, sorry. So it's been good. I had a really difficult time in the beginning, a very difficult time. But now I feel like every day, now I feel like every day gets better. And I've revised a new draft of a screenplay. I'm revising my feature. I am working on a new feature. And I came back from the Navajo Reservation, which has been uniquely hit with COVID-19. And every weekend we're on lockdown. The racial tension that comes along being from a community that's been hit hard with COVID, I've noticed in stores, you know, just my presence of, you know, presenting Indigenous, you know, obviously, and it sucks, you know, to feel those kind of like going back to like, you know, that those old racial tensions. I feel like back in the old West of like, you know, you dirty Indian. I feel like once sometimes when I go into town, I'm in, you know, getting supplies, you know, or, you know, cause it's been 4 months now, you know, we need, like I said, I need my vitamins. I need, you know, groceries and stuff. We need water filters for our water container. And so like, you know, going in and like having to get those items, you can feel eyes on you and wondering if I'm one of those Indians that have COVID. Those are the kinds of weird things that goes on in my mind. And I haven't felt that way in a really long time. You know, being in the city, I don't think twice about how I look, you know, if I really look native today, you know, just cause I'm wearing two braids. So it's been an interesting dynamic. And then you get lost in the news, and then you get lost on Facebook, and it's like things make you angry. You know, there's like a lot of anger these days, and it directly affects the way I approach my work, because I've always approached my work like how I am, I would say, like how I am in ceremony. You know, I'm very much involved with my culture and my communities. I'm not really as much involved in my Navajo side as I am with my Oglala Lakota side. And so IA was great because you're exposed to film and the people around you, your peers, your classmates, they're all Indigenous except for a few. And I'll have a funny story about that, but like a majority of the time, you know, you're surrounded by people who are like you, and it allows you to experiment and exist in those spaces and make films in a way that can come natural to us as Indigenous people. So IA is really a great place to explore that. And what I found myself doing though was not embracing that, but fighting it and trying to like create films in this very, through a very like Western colonial lens. And what I mean is like, I'm the director. You go here because I say so, and I need an assist, you know, like very much kind of like that type of thing. I mean, it wasn't until Raven where we're super bare bones. We're a 3-person crew, a sound woman, a camera woman, and myself, and the actors. And that was it. I think something shifted in me. Like, I can do this. Like, I went and made Raven. And it's like, and for me, it was very much like I will hire an Indigenous woman as a DP. I will hire an Indigenous woman as a sound person. And my lead actress is an Indigenous woman. And my supporting is a young Indigenous girl. And we're going to make this film, and it's going to be made purely by Indigenous women. And what does that look like? And so then it's just kind of, it clicked, because it was all about process and and the context wasn't purely dependent on the characters being Native. However, it totally was inherent to how the characters conducted themselves in the film is what made it Native, because I had something very powerful I wanted to say regarding suicide and women who've lost little ones, you know, before they've met them. So I wanted to honor that.
So that was in 2017 that you made that. Mm-hmm. In the years since, in reflection on, you said that film was really a turning point. And so mm-hmm. in your reflection on from since 2017 till now, and in all the types of work that you're doing, would you be able to describe either something that you've realized about your work?
I guess with Raven, process and the way I carried out making a film was so important to me, because it all boiled down to one thing that I've actually had an epiphany yesterday. And it took that long for me to realize this. But when I talk about making Raven, it was kind of out of this fiery moment in my life where I needed to make this film by myself in the way I wanted to do it without following any rules. Now I realize what I've realized now is it's very simple. People listen to you when you're a screenwriter and director. And I think for a very long time growing up and existing, my voice has always been suppressed and silenced, and I've been made to feel like what I had to say isn't important, and the way I feel isn't important for a lot of my life. And making films, being a director and writing films, people actually listen to me. It's our story. I don't really like to say it's my story. I always use we, and I don't really know who the we is ever, but it's our story. But it's coming out of my voice. So that's what's mine, you know, and no one can take that away. And I've come to that realization because of one person, and his name is Elegance Bratton. He's also a Tisch alum and also one of the advisors in the lab. And he said that yesterday, and it made me absolutely, completely emotional to like where I had to like turn off my video and like take a moment and reflect, because it hit so hard. Like that was it. That was the answer. Like, and you know, my work elicits a emotional response. And for me, that's powerful, because for a long time being an Indigenous woman, you know, people always can make you feel less than. And I'm the youngest of the family. And so I grew up in the family dynamic of like where my voice isn't heard a lot of times because I'm small, I'm a girl, I'm this, and I'm the little sister, I'm the baby of the family, you know, go on, so on and so on. It's like my whole life, I just kind of been fighting to be heard. And now being a screenwriter and director allows me to be heard. You know, when I was at IA, I just wanted to amplify the agency of Indigenous women in my work, right? And I spent a lot of time exploring that in my last 2 years in the program with James. And James is great. He really instilled what meaningful storytelling is to me. And Khalil Hudson, one of my other professors at IA, he challenged me to visually, cinematically and visually bring out my story. And when you watch Raven, a lot of my work is about like social justice within Indigenous communities. Raven is about, you know, a young woman who has lost her little one. You know, she lost her pregnancy and she goes into the forest to an attempt to commit suicide. You know, sorry, spoiler alert, but you know, it's in the context of, so she doesn't, she has an encounter with the little girl that could have been, and the little girl prevents her from taking her own life. So that was a very heavy story to make. And that's why, with like such a small intimate crew with only myself, the DP and sound person, that was all we needed, because it allowed for Morningstar, my actress, to really be vulnerable. But also with that vulnerability, you have to take care of her.
To what you were saying earlier about process, I think, and how important mm-hmm. the process is, and how that, in terms of measuring how a project goes and what it amounts to, what's as important is what you're saying, mm-hmm. the experience that the actors, mm-hmm. the crew, yourself, everybody involved have, and that those mm-hmm. two things kind of are together in a sense, instead of like, it doesn't matter what's happened. We have the shot and we have this movie now.
And exactly.
You're saying, no, it really matters.
It does matter. And just to kind of cap out that thought, you know, I truly believe every film has a spirit. And that's why it's so important for me in the way that we make the film and we foster and put ourselves into that film. It's us, you know, it's a part of all of us. And it's like, if I'm running around being a mad woman on set and yelling at people and getting into fights with my DP and my blood is boiling and my face is red, and you know, like people, you could just feel that in a film. Like, I don't like that. You know, it's like, it doesn't need to be like that. And so my films do have a spirit. And when you watch it, that's what you feel. You feel that spirit. And in Raven, that spirit is there holding your hand. And in my other films, it's like, there's just it's its own thing. And that's what the audience, that's what they react to when they watch the work. And a lot of Indigenous people believe that. Merata Mita, New Zealand female director, she believed that her films had a spirit. And I didn't know that until I was explaining to Bird Running Water from the Sundance Institute. I'm like, yeah, I truly believe, you know, I've been thinking about my work, saying what I'm saying to you. Then he's like, you know, well, you know who else thought that was Merata Mita? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah.
Really appreciate your thoughts. For us, it's exciting also just to talk to a young filmmaker working and thinking about mm-hmm. these things.
But yeah, just to quickly, I'll just give you a log line for my new film that's being edited right now. It's called Okia, which means help. It's about a young girl, her older brother, their horse. As they go out hunting on the land, the girl encounters an owl, which she doesn't know if it's a good omen or bad omen, but the story is about the girl going missing. The overarching theme is missing and murdered Indigenous girls, but it's also, it's kind of like weaved in with this encounter with an owl and the idea that an owl can either be a messenger of sickness or death, or is also a protector. So we don't know if this owl is warning her or trying to protect her. But we shot in 16mm film in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Yeah, and then that film was funded by Spike Lee. So Professor Lee got behind that project and supported it.
That was Chelsea Reedy talking with Rizal Benali. Find out more about Rizal and her short film Raven on Vimeo. Next week, we'll hear from Melanie Kirby, an apiculturist who established Zia Queen Bee's Farm and Field Institute, which has provided pollination services for diverse communities around northern New Mexico. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, Knight Financial Limited, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truthouseradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Crystal Starr. Have a good day.